Prime Time replay from Money FM 89.3.
Muslims in Sri Lanka were urged to stay at home to avoid mosques or churches after warnings of a possible car bomb attacks over concerns of retaliatory violence for the Easter Sunday bombings. Well, ISIS has since claimed responsibility for the suicide attacks, and the government has admitted to major lapses over its ability to prevent the attacks, despite receiving intelligence warnings weeks before. Now, to discuss further, we speak to Joshua Chambers, founder and managing editor of Gulf Insider. Hundreds of Pakistani Muslims have fled the country following concerns over their safety after locals have threatened revenge. I mean, given the severity of the attacks, how can the government ensure the tensions do not worsen and restore stability between communities, Joshua?
You talk of stability, but Sri Lanka is a tinderbox nation with a history of tension and trauma. Let's not forget that it had a civil war that lasted from 1983 to 2009 between a majority Buddhist Sinhalese population and the minority Hindu Tamils. And the barbarity and aggression in this war was absolutely extraordinary. Suicide bombing was invented during this war by the Tamil Tigers, who even managed to assassinate the Prime Minister of India using this method. Meanwhile, the Buddhist majority rioted and burned people alive. It was an incredibly violent time for the nation, which had still only just started to heal from that incredibly difficult time in their history. That instability, of course, was caused in part by the British Empire, who had favored the minority Tamil population for lucrative jobs and education over the majority, and when they left, saw a complete reversion of that standard. So it's a very, very difficult situation anyhow, and it'll be very difficult to ensure there's stability and that there is not tension in a nation that's already on edge. Certainly it could learn a lot from Singapore in how Singapore has built racial tolerance and racial harmony. I think given this is Money FM, there's also one other point to note, which is that as it's been recovering from the civil war, Sri Lanka has started to build an incredibly strong tourism industry, and this year was named as Lonely Planet Destination of the Year. That status will now have been completely destroyed, with nations across the world warning their citizens not to attend. So there will also now be a vast hit to the economy, with further repercussions for the people living there.
Now, ISIS has claimed responsibility for the bombings, and Sri Lankan State Minister Defence, Mr. Ruwan Wijayawardene, has attributed the attacks as a retaliation for the Christchurch massacre last month. Now, it took place just last month. How likely do you think this was an act of revenge?
Well, this is about ISIS, not about any particular mosque massacre. Who knows how long it took to plan this particular act, but this was caused by people returning from Syria, as ISIS has been crushed in Syria, and looking to use those tools of violence that they have learned in their home nation. It's not something Sri Lanka alone is facing. Of course, here in Southeast Asia as well, many governments are aware of exactly the same problem. There are people returning in Sri Lanka. It's an unknown number. The government hasn't been able to track them. They're radicalized. They're angry. They want to fight people. And Christchurch was just an excuse for violence.
Okay, taking responsibility for the attacks, Defence Secretary Himasiri Fernando has resigned after the government admitted to receiving intelligence warnings weeks before the attacks. But what does this reflect about the government authorities' treatment towards these warnings? I mean, are these warnings not taken seriously?
Well, this is a government that anyhow for a long time now has been consumed by infighting between factions and in functionality terms has been in complete chaos. Muslim terrorism itself has not been seen as a vast threat in Sri Lanka because it's been enjoying that rare period of peace after a bloody civil war, and instead the nation's institutions have been totally distracted after the abortive coup attempt last year, where a former prime minister tried to seize back control with the backing of the president. That completely split Sri Lanka's institutions between supporters of the former prime minister and supporters of the current prime minister, and people have not been focusing on their day-to-day tasks at all in government. That is all, when you speak to people in Sri Lanka, what they have been talking about in government for the past few months.
Now, it was announced earlier today that the officials have lowered the death toll by about 100 to the new official figure of 253. This was due to double counting. And then there was the police having admitted to wrongly identifying a woman as a suspect. Now, and in restoring all this, you know, given the prevalence of fake news, what's the severity, do you think, of these, of all this inaccurate information contributing to, say, public anger, frustration?
It's very difficult after this sort of incident to have an exact idea of what has happened anyway. In this case, I actually sympathise very much with the government officials who will be doing their best to get out accurate information while investigating what was an enormously shocking incident. Fake news, of course, may play a part, but I don't think that that's going to be the big problem here. The real issue for government is how it's ignored warnings on this in the first place and how it can now figure out who's responsible and act in a way that's actually appropriate and doesn't further inflame tensions.
Well, Sri Lankan Prime Minister was reportedly not alerted to the warnings following a feud with the president, as he was no longer invited to council meetings. So how has this rift affected government decisions?
They both essentially hate one another. So this is going to be very difficult for them to work together for the future of the nation. And what we have to hope is that the opposition now doesn't try and capitalize on this to win power and cause further instability in the nation at a time when its security is at risk and it's really trying to deal with an enormous crisis. But as I said earlier, since December last year, the country has been in political chaos, completely focused on the issue of who is in power. The Prime Minister was turfed out of government. The opposition former Prime Minister was brought in, then this was found unconstitutional. And the whole institution of government has not been functioning now for months. And we can see that it's going to be very, very difficult for the different factions to unite and to work together on what needs to be done within Sri Lanka.
And you think this is the main crux of it all, for them to regain the trust of its people and the international community? What else do you think they need to do?
You talk about regaining the trust of people. The problem with Sri Lankan government institutions is that there's very low levels of trust statistically for a very long time. Sri Lanka is very famous in Transparency International ranking for having high levels of institutional corruption. Political bribery is quite commonplace, according to many international studies as well. So you will need to see a very rare instance of politicians from all parts of the community coming together to tackle this issue. And alongside that, there needs to be a focus on the broader institutions of government. How do they function? How are they working? How can Sri Lanka reduce or eliminate that infighting? And how can it reduce that politicking and low-level bribery and corruption that's dogging in the institutions and that many international observers such as Transparency International, the OECD, have been commenting on for a very long time? Unless Sri Lanka can put that sort of proper structure in place, unless it can make those institutions work effectively, then trust is going to remain very, very low, and it's going to be very difficult to have a cohesive and proper response to the issues that have arisen there.
Well, we'll be talking to Joshua Chambers, founder and managing editor of Gulf Insider. Well, let's shift our attention now to Indonesia, Joshua. We just had its presidential election on April the 17th. Even though the official results won't be out till May 22nd, I believe, it seems almost certain that President Joko Widodo will win the election. How likely would Mr. Joko delivering what he promised this election, such as to generate higher economic growth? What are your views?
I think investors will be very happy with the results of this election. The president has been a strong supporter of international investment within Indonesia. He's also been a real champion of the technology industry and has essentially overseen the emergence and growth of very large companies such as Gojek or Traveloka, big unicorn tech industry that didn't exist before his time in office. When it comes to delivering, he will stay the course on what he has done in the previous election, which was about cleaning up the institution of government, which is about creating clearer framework for people to be investing in Indonesia and enabling a little bit more foreign direct investment in Indonesia as well. He's also been someone who's been highly committed to building infrastructure, be that roads, be that high-speed rail. But this election wasn't really about delivery. It was an argument about culture. It was an argument about identity. So we don't know fully what he's committed to in this next term, but I think what we can say is it's going to be stability and continuation of the previous administration with very little change and very few big picture investments, more about the smaller scale stuff of making Indonesia a good place to invest.
Well, speaking of continuity, I mean, Mr. Joko has reshuffled his cabinet four times in his first term. Now, if he wins the second, you think it will make it easier for him to choose his aides?
Absolutely. And let's not forget, when he won last time around, he was a very, very weak figure because he needed the backing of political parties. He wasn't a party. He was totally underpinned by a former president. And this time around, he has won the election in his own right. He's in a very, very strong position. And equally, his running mate was someone who he has chosen for their political position in the Muslim community that doesn't have any experience within politics and government. So he doesn't have any rival. He's easily able to choose the people who he wants to work for him. And he has to pay much less attention to the factions that he did last time. So as you ask, how is he going to be able to choose his cabinet? He's going to be able much more this time to put the right people who he personally wants into those roles. What we saw last time was he had people who were essentially his rivals. For example, the current governor of Jakarta, Governor Anis, was in Jokowi's cabinet for a couple of years. He was then fired because there was a lot of infighting within that cabinet between people who were trying to win jobs and win power and influence. Jokowi's position this time around is going to be very, very powerful, and that gives him a lot more sway.
Well, Joshua Chambers, thank you very much. As usual, it's always nice to hear from you. Joshua Chambers is founder and managing editor of Gulf Insider. And thank you for sharing your thoughts and your comments right here on Money FM 89.3.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.